stage.
I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong.
It's not really about going to another star system. It's about how do we improve life here on Earth.
Not only the question, but the way you try to solve it.
Beauty at this dimension of 1 centimeter is also beauty at a smaller dimension.
Hello and welcome to Sharing Science Radio. We're broadcasting from CITR 101.9 on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. Here you'll hear about how science is done, who's doing it, what it's telling us, and why it matters to you. I'm your host, Al Manning, and with me today is Tanya Rusi.
Hello.
And Damian Quinton.
Hey.
So, a couple Fridays ago, we went to an industrial park beside Production Waste Station. We were there to tour General Fusion, a Vancouver company that is designing a nuclear fusion power plant.
My name is Michael Delage. I'm the VP of Technology and Corporate Strategy at General Fusion.
Michael was our tour guide, and over the next hour and a half, he showed us around and talked about General Fusion's technology.
So there's a lot of really nice, attractive features around fusion, if we can get there and make it work.
Today on Sharing Science, generating power with nuclear fusion. What it is, why you should care, and how close are we to actually making it happen? So before we dive into the details, it's worthwhile going over just what sort of nuclear reaction fusion is. Most power plants use heat to make steam and drive a generator. The heat is created either with nuclear reactions or chemical reactions. And chemical reactions, like burning coal, are great because they're so easy to do. But nuclear reactions release way more energy. How much more? Let's imagine I have a coal-fired power plant and one day I burn about a blue whale's worth of weight in coal. But you have a nuclear power plant. So to release the same amount of energy as my coal power plant, all you would need is a single piece of uranium about the size of a cherry. So with such high energy density, the advantages and challenges of nuclear power are obvious. But here's the thing, there are actually two types of nuclear reactions that can take place, nuclear fission and nuclear fusion. Fission is when heavier atoms split into lighter atoms, and fusion is when lighter atoms fuse together into heavier atoms, and they both can release a butt ton of energy. The boundary between light atoms you can fuse and heavy atoms you can split is iron. So generally, nuclear fission uses fuels, like uranium, that are much heavier than iron, and nuclear fusion uses fuels, like helium, that are much lighter than iron. And nuclear fission is way easier to do, so that's the way that all nuclear power plants do it today. Nuclear fission is a chain reaction, so under the right conditions, more and more atoms split apart until the fuel is gone. We've learned to control nuclear fission extremely well, but it's still the type of control that requires constant braking. On the other hand, nuclear fusion is not a chain reaction. It doesn't happen spontaneously, so unless the conditions are right, the reaction stops. So it's actually very challenging to get going and to maintain. The problem is that in order to get two atoms to fuse together, you have to get their atomic nuclei to touch. But each nucleus is positively charged, so because like charges repel, they try and push each other away. So how do we actually get them to smack into each other? By heating them up. Because as things heat up, atoms move around faster and faster, bumping into each other with more and more force. And that's actually what warmth is. When you're feeling nice and toasty, it's just fast-moving atoms smacking into you. So how hot do we need to make things for nuclear fusion? Oh, you know, just a chilly 10 million degrees Celsius. And that's such a ridiculously high temperature, I don't even know how to begin to imagine that. But a star like our sun has so much gravitational squeezing going on in its center that it can reach this temperature without any trouble. However, getting things this hot in a facility on Earth is very hard, especially maintaining it for a long time. When anything gets this hot, it becomes something called a plasma. A plasma is a gas where the atoms have their electrons ripped off of them. It's basically a soup of electrons and atomic nuclei. And you don't even need to get things that hot. Any fluorescent light bulb has a plasma inside it when it's switched on. So that's the basic idea behind what General Fusion is doing. They take some very light atoms, just some different hydrogen isotopes, and heat them up in a plasma hot enough to get the atomic nuclei to fuse together. But why would a fusion power plant be so great? Here's Michael explaining how it would compare to current ways of generating power.
So fusion is fusing nuclei. How is fusion different from conventional nuclear power?
Well, if you think of a periodic table, what we're trying to do in fusion is take the lightest atoms, hydrogen, and fuse them together. And fission, what they're trying to do is take the biggest, heaviest atoms, and uranium, and break them apart. And the biggest differences are, first, fusion is pretty hard to do. So we need to heat the fuel up to 150 million degrees in order to get that reaction to go. So that's pretty hard. And that means that in the process, if you're doing fusion research or you're trying to make a fusion power plant work, if anything breaks, you're just never going to achieve those conditions and fizzles and nothing happens. Fission, on the other hand, is a reaction that tends to want to go on its own. So it's a naturally occurring and spontaneous reaction. You put enough uranium together in a big pile and the reaction starts to go. And so the challenge in fission reactors sometimes is if you lose control of that reaction, you can melt the hardware. This is called meltdown, and you can have accidents. The other big difference is when you fuse hydrogen together, what you produce is helium. And helium is what we use in our party balloons and so on. It's safe. It's inert. It's not an issue. So the byproduct of the reaction is not a concern. In fission, when you take uranium and you break it into pieces, those pieces you're left over with are often radioactive for a long, long time, tens of thousands of years, and dangerously so. And so you've got this problem of spent fuel that you've got to manage for a long time. So in fusion, you don't have either the long-term radioactive waste, and you also don't have the risk of a meltdown or anything like that. And if you can crack fusion, the benefits would be massive. Is it a done deal? Is it a guarantee? No, it's not. This is still very much a high-risk endeavor, but the payoff, if we're successful, is so big that it's certainly worth taking that risk. And the idea is so attractive in terms of its practicality that we really want to try and pursue that.
Why is it so attractive? Why is it more attractive than solar or wind?
Well, first off, I'm a big supporter of renewables, so the more solar or wind we can build, the better. But as you get more and more solar and wind on a grid, it becomes more of a challenge. Either you have to add costs in terms of storage, or you have to add costs in terms of extensive transmission grids so you can move the wind energy from one place where it is blowing to a place where it isn't blowing, or you need backup power, right? Fusion is something that you could build anywhere, and you can build it close to centers of demand. It's 24/7 available power. It's essentially inexhaustible fuel supply with no environmental footprint. It actually, in terms of the amount of land it would require, is very small. So there's a lot of really nice, attractive features around fusion if we can get there and make it work.
You said the fuel supply is inexhaustible. Can mm-hmm. you quantify that?
Sure. The main fuel we want to use is deuterium, and there's enough deuterium on Earth. It's about one part in 5,000 of all hydrogen, so there's enough for a few billion years to, you know, essentially as long as the sun is going to last. I'd say that's essentially inexhaustible.
General Fusion is not the only entity trying to make a nuclear fusion power plant. Governments around the world have been funding fusion and plasma physics research for years. Projects with names like the National Ignition Facility, the Wendelstein Stellarator, and ITER are currently trying to crack the challenge that is sustained nuclear fusion. And other private companies have also joined the party, including big names like Lockheed Martin. They're all trying to create a nuclear fusion reactor that can generate more power out than is put in. And General Fusion's approach is fairly unique among these, as Damien explains.
So there isn't one way to make a fusion reactor that produces more energy than you put in. General Fusion's approach is essentially to recreate the conditions of the sun. So what General Fusion is doing is they're essentially taking this set of atoms, these isotopes of hydrogen, and they're heating them up to 150 million degrees Celsius. They're creating this tiny little smoke ring of them that, you know, this the size of your fist, essentially. And they're shooting this fist-sized smoke ring of atoms into the center of this giant molten lead sphere, and then they pound it with a huge wave of pressure. And this essentially, for a split moment in time, creates this ultra-hot, ultra-high-pressure environment where these ultra-light atoms fuse together.
So as we tour around, we're going to see really two big aspects of what we're trying to do. General Fusion's technology is about first forming a hot blob of plasma. Plasma is just a superheated gas, so we want to heat something up and wrap it in magnetic fields. It's a bit like making a soap bubble, but instead of a bubble, it's got a soap film. This is going to be a donut-shaped plasma. So we're going to do that,
And then we want to try and compress it. And by compressing it, we're going to, again, heat it up. We're going to increase its density and so on. So the two steps there are first forming this donut of plasma and preheating it and wrapping it in a magnetic field, and then the compression step.
Michael took us around, and we start off the tour. First, we walk through the kitchen, and all the food there looked delicious. It seems like the employees are really well taken care of. And then we walked into this big industrial area, and you start off with this facility where they can make pretty much everything. They've got all these machines to work with metal and put it together, take it apart, put holes in it, all that kind of stuff. And they really build a lot of their own equipment. Then we walked over to something called the plasma injector.
And this is a plasma injector, and so that's the machine that actually forms these plasmas to begin with.
So this is like a great big spark plug.
This is a really big spark plug, I guess. Yeah, it's one way to look at it. A controlled lightning bolt, maybe.
Controlled lightning bolt, that's awesome.
And this is something that's about as big as a jet engine, or actually it looks like the rear part of a cement mixer. It's kind of cylindrical, and it's big, but it's got all these wires hanging off of it. And it's basically designed to produce this smoke ring of plasma, this super hot plasma at one end, and then it fires it down the cone, squeezing it as it goes, heating it up even more to about 150 million degrees. And the cool thing is they've got a whole whack load of sensors hanging off this thing. They're collecting data on all parts of the plasma.
So we're measuring the magnetic field as it goes down. We're measuring the density of the plasma as it goes down. We're measuring the temperature in places so that we understand exactly what's going on with this plasma as it goes down, and making sure that we don't pop the bubble, that it keeps its structure and holds the heat in the way we want it to do it.
They're really true scientists here because they analyze everything they do and they're constantly improving on it.
One thing I did ask Michael about was if the plasma is so hot, 150 million degrees Celsius, how do you even keep it inside this thing? Why doesn't it just melt a hole through the wall?
Why doesn't it just melt through the edge of the container?
Well, the magnetic field holds the heat in. So we're talking a very small amount of gas that's being heated up to that kind of temperature, like milligrams. And the magnetic field that's wrapped around it keeps that gas going around the circle of the donut and not touching the walls. So the magnetic field's like insulation. It holds the heat in and prevents it from touching the wall. And if it does touch the wall, it's not going to melt a hole in the wall. It's a bit like a match getting thrown in a bathtub. So if you throw a match in a bathtub, the match may be hot, hotter than the boiling point of water, but the whole bathtub doesn't vaporize into steam, the match goes out. And the same thing happens. If we lose our magnetic structure, if that bubble bursts and then the hot gas touches the wall, it just cools off.
After showing us the plasma injector, we walked over to another building. And here we saw the second part of the reactor, the mini-sphere. This is the thing that the plasma injector fires its plasma into. It's actually not that mini, as Tanya will tell us.
It basically looks like an enormous version of the everlasting gobstopper from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So what it is it's a sphere with a bunch of pistons sticking out of it. And they have the lead on the inside and the plasma inside of that. And at the exact same time, like down to the millisecond, they fire every single piston. What this does is it creates a spherical shock wave down to the center, which creates a huge implosion. In that implosion, the plasma heats up even hotter and is under so much pressure that the nuclei are forced to touch each other. And when they do, amazing things happen. When two nuclei touch each other, they fuse to become one. When two become one. And in that moment, a tiny little bit of mass is lost. And that brings us to the most famous equation in all of physics. Einstein's famous E equals mc squared basically says that E, energy, is equal to mass times a really big number squared. So if you lose a little bit of mass, it turns into a huge amount of energy.
So we're standing in front of a machine that we've come to call the mini sphere. It's not very small if you're standing in front of it, but this is a prototype of the compression technology that we want to use in a power plant. So one of the key ideas behind what General Fusion is doing is no matter what you're doing in fusion, you want to heat up your fuel to 150 million degrees. So it takes a lot of energy, and you have to focus a lot of energy in a spot to heat anything up to those kind of temperatures. When it comes to thinking about how do you make a practical power plant, where you get that energy from is going to have a lot to do with what your chances of being economically competitive are. So some fusion systems use big laser systems, like football fields full of lasers. Well, a football field full of lasers is really, really expensive.
It's not scalable.
What general fusion is essentially uses compressed gas. So our energy comes from focusing the energy that's delivered by a whole bunch of hammers, essentially big jackhammers. Jackhammers are cheap, lasers are expensive, right? And that's really kind of the crux of what general fusion is trying to do. So this system is a prototype for testing out a lot of the pieces of that technology. It's a sphere in the middle that on the inside is 1 meter across. It's got 14 pistons all around it. Each of these pistons is able to deliver a big whack of energy. So it's like a big jackhammer. It takes compressed gas. It uses that compressed gas to accelerate a big piece of steel. And that gets faster and faster and faster. It can go up to about 180 kilometers an hour. And then it hits, bang, steel on steel against what we call the anvil. It's like a plug that's in the inside of that, sphere. And that plug moves a little bit when it gets hit. On the inside of the sphere, it's filled with molten metal. It's liquid lead in this case. If anybody's soldered pipes or electronics, think solder. Well, it's a few hundred degrees C, and so the smack from the big piece of steel transfers into this liquid metal, and that sets up a pressure wave going into the liquid metal. And so when you have a big array of these around in a circle, in a sphere, they're all pointing towards the middle. All of that energy gets focused as it goes towards the center. And so you can generate extremely high pressures at the center of the sphere. Now with only 14 pistons here, it's not enough to do fusion. So you may have seen pictures of this machine a lot of places, but it's not actually a fusion machine. This is really just a test of the compression system. For fusion, we need to make it bigger, and we'll get there. But a fusion power plant using general fusion technology would be a 3 meter diameter sphere on the inside instead of 1 meter, and it would be about 200 of these pistons instead of just 14.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. After, we'll hear more from Michael about the safety of nuclear fusion, fusion skeptics, and what it's like to be an innovative company in Vancouver. This is Dick Valentine from Electric Six. You're listening to CITR 101.9, University of British Columbia. When a problem needs a problem solver, guess who gets the call? Me asshole. You're tuned in with a black revolver. Guess who dropped the ball? The writing's on the wall. The president of the Cabernet loves the Senate Green. From New York to Los Angeles and all points in between. Burning 50 million megawatts. Welcome back to Sharing Science Radio. Today we're talking nuclear fusion with Michael Delage from General Fusion. If you're just joining us, here's Michael explaining what nuclear fusion is.
Fusion is the process that powers the stars. So fusion is nature's way of making energy, right? It's a reaction that happens at extremely high temperatures when you collide two atoms together and they stick. And in the process, a little tiny bit of mass is turned into a whole lot of energy. On Earth, what fusion really means is taking hydrogen and forcing it together and forming helium. And in the process, that would release a lot of energy. So that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to harness that process here.
Since the idea of nuclear power can be uncomfortable, we asked Michael what the relationship with the public is like and about the safety of what they're doing.
Well, general fusion, and I don't know necessarily how people perceive it from the outside, but from our point of view, we've tried very much to be fairly open about what we're doing. So we've talked with the media. We do school tours here in the Vancouver area. We bring a lot of students through, that kind of thing. I think we're trying to tell people about what's going on and be open to what it's all about. I think, like I said, that when there have been stories and coverage of general fusion, by and large, it's been very hopeful and positive. People are very excited that this is going on here, and not just here in BC, but here in Canada. People, when they go to other
provinces or conferences, things, people are excited that this kind of project is taking shape and taking place in Canada. So that feels pretty good.
So we're familiar with the disasters that can happen with fission, like Chernobyl. What's the absolute worst thing that could happen in a fusion power plant?
I think a fusion power plant, from a safety point of view, at least general fusions for sure, the main risks are industrial risks. They're not nuclear risks. So the worst things that can happen are concerns that we would worry about for people that would work there. We have high voltage systems that can be dangerous. We will have molten metal. We'll have high pressures, those kind of things. But they're not risks that would endanger the general public.
So having a fusion power plant down the street poses little risk to its neighbors?
Yeah, that's right. In the case of what we're trying to do here at General Fusion, and fusion in general is something that would be inherently safe for the neighbors and the communities it's in.
If it's fairly safe, then what keeps you up at night?
It's hard. What keeps us up at night here at General Fusion, and this is the thing, is fusion has all these wonderful characteristics, but you're trying to create conditions that are really quite extreme in terms of the temperatures involved. And nature doesn't like that. Nature doesn't like something that's 150 million degrees sitting next to something that's room temperature. It's trying to shed that heat any way possible. And so when you're trying to heat your fuel up and keep it there, it doesn't want to stay that way. And so the big challenge with fusion, we can make fusion reactions happen, but doing it in a way that makes enough fusion reactions happen that we produce more energy than what it took to do that in the first place. That's the big challenge, and so what keeps us up at night is our approach and trying to make it work.
So anyone who reads a bit into the history of nuclear fusion knows that it's full of broken promises. It's one of these technologies that is always 30 years away. Many are skeptical that a fusion power plant is feasible, and some are even skeptical of general fusion in particular. The late Dr. Eric Vogt, a UBC physics professor that co-founded Triumph, once called general fusion cloud cuckoo land. We asked Michael what he thought of this skepticism.
Well, I think there's a few things there. There have been a lot of hope around fusion over the decades. So for sure, if you go back and you look at 1970s or so, people were thinking that hopefully it was just around the corner. And we haven't got fusion power plants yet, so maybe missed expectations. At the same time, I think fusion gets a bad rap in that people say, well, fusion's 30 years away, and they were saying it was 30 years away when I was a kid, and now it's still 30 years away. That sort of gives the impression that no progress is being made, when in fact a huge amount of progress has been made. If you look at actually from the experiments that have gone on, the amount of fusion energy that's being produced in labs from the 1970s until the last 10 years, it's gone up a factor of 10,000. It's actually fusion progress in terms of energy being produced is gone as fast as Moore's Law. And people are in awe of the progress of Moore's Law. So I think the fusion research community gets a bum rap for the idea that, hey, maybe nothing's going on. And I think that what we're seeing now is as we have had that amount of progress and we get very, very close to sort of energy-producing fusion systems, people are thinking more and more about what are the best ways to produce a fusion power plant. And so I think whether it's because of cold fusion or maybe early hope that was maybe ahead of itself, or certainly people, whether it's Dr. Vogt or others, have got a healthy amount of skepticism around fusion. But I think if you look closely at actually the work that's gone on, there is real reason to be hopeful that we are getting closer and closer to those days where we'll have real power plants.
Do you think this persistent skepticism is caused in part just by a lack of understanding that fusion has progressed through the years? Or is it caused also by other factors?
Until it's done, I don't think that you can blame people for being skeptical when you're talking about the potential benefits from fusion. So I don't have a problem with people wanting to see it, to believe it. But I also do think that there's a little bit of a bad rap here in terms of the idea that people in fusion haven't made any progress and it's not really gone anywhere and we've spent all this money. And the actual progress in the science has come a huge way and the understanding has come such a long way. It's also not fair to say it doesn't make sense to invest in this, that we had our chance, it didn't work, let's move on. That's not true either. We've made a huge amount of progress, and we're now at the point where we could see potentially some really promising concepts around what a power plant could be.
One of the coolest things I think we saw on our tour was a graph showing how long General Fusion was able to hold on to their plasma for, basically how long they could have a protected bubble of superheated gas inside their machine before it cooled off. When they first started, it would dissipate as soon as it was created, but they kept on improving month by month. The progress was tangible until they're able to maintain their plasma long enough for their purposes. It was almost enough to make me believe that a power plant was actually in reach. So assuming General Fusion proves their approach can work, what next?
Well, there's a few steps. So right now we're working on a lot of the components in separate pieces. We've got work to do to get them to the levels of performance and to understand the physics to the level that we would feel confident to go build a full-scale machine. The first full-scale machine we build, though, isn't going to be a power plant. And I talked about a power plant where these hammers run one time per second. The first time we build a full-scale machine, it'll be one time a day. It'll be, you know, one pulse at a time. Can we get the conditions right? And then we'll start to worry about, can we do a few pulses in a row? Can we start to see that one time per second? And then we'll start to worry about, can we do it reliably and build a power plant that will operate for, you know, decades and be maintainable and all of those things. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of steps along the way that happen beyond the, hey, we can produce more energy than we consume from fusion. But I also think that the number of partners and the people we work with will grow as we go through that. So building a reliable power plant, I mean, there are a lot of people that know how to build power plants out there, and we'll want to work with them and when we get to that stage, right?
So could the first nuclear fusion power plant be in Vancouver? Michael also says that this city is actually a pretty good place for a company like theirs.
I think Vancouver is an exciting spot right now. There is an interesting amount of companies in Vancouver that, from my perspective, and I grew up in Ottawa, that in Vancouver I see more of the companies that are kind of taking fundamental science and using that to push some bigger innovations, right? Whether it's General Fusion or a company like D-Wave. You've got other companies that are in biofuels or desalination or
fuel cells,
biotechnology, right? There's a lot of this stuff that is built around sort of fundamental science to go after big problems, and that's fantastic. And I don't know that you see that mix as strongly elsewhere in Canada. That said, are there things we could be doing better in Canada? For sure, there are things we could be doing better in Canada. And I think there are examples, whether it's in Silicon Valley or in Israel or elsewhere, where the interaction and the working of government and finance and startups and universities, national lab, that circle works better to produce these kind of successful innovations. And I think we could do more.
Finally, we wanted to know why Michael decided to join a company like General Fusion that's trying to accomplish something so challenging.
So I don't know in the end whether it's going to work. I think we have a really good shot. I think that the physics as we understand it somewhere right now is very promising. So sure, I think it really could work. And you don't get too many chances in your life to be a part of something that could have as big an impact. So if it doesn't work, I won't feel bad about it. At the same time, I think it has a chance of really working. And if you've got a chance to be a part of something like that, I think you have to go for it.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much to Michael and everyone else at General Fusion. They were extremely generous with their time and gave us an awesome tour and interview. If you'd like to learn more about their company, they've got a great TED Talk and plenty of media coverage on their website, generalfusion.com. Also, thanks to West Pride for the music in today's show. You can check his stuff out at soundcloud.com/West Pride. That's P-R-Y-D-E. As always, you can get in touch with us by emailing ubcsharingscience@gmail.com, and you can find our previous episodes on citr.ca. Next week, we're talking about the science of GMOs, or genetically modified organisms. We're Sharing Science. I'm Alan Manning, and today I was joined by Tanya Rusi and Damian Quinton. Up next is Innerspace. Good night, everyone.